Hello, I am Richard Booker. I'm a haematologist in the West Midlands, England, and this is Don't Just Read the Guidelines. Don't Just Read the Guidelines is a podcast that explores ideas and research at the cutting edge of medicine, especially anything to do with blood. I aim to provide a platform to incredible people you probably haven't heard from before and share their work, ideas, and opinions. We will take you beyond the guidelines and into the research behind them, and most importantly, into the sticky world of opinion and conjecture. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform, and don't forget to leave a review, as it really helps others to find the show. If you would like to come on the podcast or know someone else who would be great, please find me on Twitter, at Richard Booker. Hello, welcome to Don't Just Read the Guidelines. This episode I'm joined by Sophie Evans, who is an IMT1, so an internal medicine trainee, year one, shortly to be IMT2 in the southwest of England. I met Sophie at the Crucible this year at the British Society of Haematology. So she entered the Crucible competition, which is essentially a philosophical question that's posed every year, and then people write it with abstracts, and then we pick the top five to do a talk. And Sophie's talk was brilliant, and I just had to get her on the show to talk to her in more detail about some of the ideas. So welcome, Sophie.
Thank you. It's exciting.
So just tell me about you. Why did you become a doctor? Because clearly you've got lots of other interests in the arts and humanities. What put you onto being a doctor?
I'm not sure why I was interested in medicine from the beginning. You get asked to make these decisions so early. You know, you're 13 and don't even know who you are yet, and you're being asked to choose all your topics in advance of your future. I think it's the combination of kind of problem solving, but also other people's stories that sounded interesting. And I didn't even get into medicine the first time from school, actually. So I had some time out and I went and studied biomedical science at UWE in Bristol, which is a fantastic place. It's one of the reasons I've come back into the Southwest. And just throughout it was thinking, what kind of career do I want in healthcare? It's so broad. So you've got that opportunity to consider, do I want to go along through medicine or research? And you're always being recruited by pharmaceutical companies and so on. But ultimately, I'd kept doing like shadowing. I was a tea girl in French A Hospital as well, just kind of chatting to people and getting to know the teams there, and then shadowing various doctors, and thought, actually, that is what I want to do. So I ended up doing medicine as a graduate. But I'd had these like fantastic hematology lectures from, I believe she's now a professor, Jenny May at UWE. And she just, her research interest is in the kind of bone marrow environment following chemotherapy and looking at kind of secondary hematological malignancies. That's kind of by the by. She was just an excellent lecturer and got me interested in hematology really early on. And that sort of stuck throughout medical school, even though I think it's perhaps not covered as well in I don't know, I did a graduate course, and maybe because it's accelerated, there's not time, but it didn't feel as though it was covered as well at medical school as it was in undergrad, where you got the time to go into detail. So I've sort of progressed through, and once I kind of completed medical school and started working, I just had this idea that hematology was what I was aiming for. I'd stayed interested in it, and so kind of took a medical rather than surgical or anything route, and did a clinical fellow year last year in Gloucester and Cheltenham, where you're sort of a baby or very supported registrar, getting to do outpatient, inpatient, bone marrows, bit of answering bleeps and referrals and things. And it was just, yeah, it's definitely what I want to be doing.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a bit biased, really. I mean, hematology is a great specialty. There's, because it's so varied. I mean, you can be doing transfusion, H&T, malignancy, diagnostics, seeing patients. I'm interested in your sort of route into medicine. I mean, do you feel like coming into medicine as a bit later in life as it makes you a better doctor? Do you think it's a better decision? I mean, clearly, as you said before, you're making decisions at the age of 13, and maybe some of those people that ultimately get into medicine have probably made the wrong decision for them. What do you think?
Potentially. I mean, I still think I went straight from my undergrad degree into medicine. So I think I was one of the like shortest career breaks. You know, I did graduate medicine at Warwick, which is a purely graduate course. So you have sort of 150 people in the year. And I think the majority of people would have done something else. And you know, we had students in their sort of 40s who'd had full careers in finance or health related. Maybe they've been paramedics or nurses or something and decided to retrain. So I think, I don't know, I probably had the least thinking time out of everyone. But no, I agree. And I was considering other careers alongside my application to medicine. Actually, I was particularly considering journalism, which I haven't pursued much since. I got really involved in the university newspaper early on. And then, I don't know, medicine takes over, doesn't it? The amount of time that you have.
It's funny, really. My work experience in year 10 was, had a week at the Newport Advertiser, which is a tiny little paper in Shropshire. And ultimately after that, sort of decided that life wasn't for me. But I guess, you know, doing this podcast and things is sort of journalism, really. And as you get older, you just sort of want to talk to people and find out their stories. And really, in academia, is, you know, a lot of research is trying to sell your own story, whether that's in publications or, you know, trying to get funding. And actually, the writing side of things is so fundamentally important to your job and selling that story, that there's a real strong crossover of skills that you need for both. But I mean, we want to talk about storytelling, because I saw your talk at the Crucible, which I had the pleasure of chairing. And I guess for those who don't know what the Crucible is, this is a competition run at the British Society of Haematology annual meeting. It's been going for around 5 or 6 years. And every year we ask a sort of philosophical question. And this year's was, what can haematologists learn from history? And your talk was all about stories in medicine and storytelling. And I know afterwards, I mean, the talk didn't quite win, but it was in a strong field, and it really was great. And afterwards, audience members coming up to me and just saying that was such a great talk, with beautifully sort of hand illustrated slides, and we'll talk about that later. Just to sort of introduce this, do you want to just talk about your abstract and your talk and some of the ideas therein?
Sure. It took me quite a while. I thought it was something that I'd like to do. I'm not a natural public speaker, so I'm not really sure what drew me to it. It makes me very nervous, but I thought it was something I'd like to get involved in. And it took me so long brainstorming, because it's such a broad question, you know, trying to work out, is it, what can haematology learn from the history of medicine, history more generally? And then I was like, who am I to comment on what can it learn from history? I don't know all that much about history. And I was reading or rereading Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of All Maladies. I just love it. It's an excellent book. And just thought, what has drawn me to read this while I'm considering this talk? And I think it's because he puts everything across so beautifully in stories, and I find them so much more engaging than I do kind of journal articles and so on. That's not to diss journal articles. If you need an answer to something, you need to go straight to kind of data and more kind of scientific writing. But I don't know, I just sort of started reflecting on, why have I been drawn to this, and what is its use? How do we use stories? How could we use them more? And so that's what kind of got me started on my topic. And all throughout medical school, I had still considered this sort of viewpoint. And we had a few tutors who found this area of kind of narrative-based medicine very interesting and incorporated it into their practice. So I had this other book given to me by one of the GP tutors, which is called Narrative-Based Medicine. And I started reading around that a little bit more, and just trying to work out what its place is in what I do day to day. What things have I not noticed that I do?
So what's narrative-based medicine? Tell me a bit more.
Yeah, so it's, I'm never going to be able to give a good description of this now. I should get my book. Wait. So we've got this book, Narrative-Based Medicine, which I think is quite old now. Still relevant. And it will say, the central theme of this book is the narrative nature of illness and the consequent need for interpretation as well as investigation of the patient's problem. And so it's kind of that incorporation of humanities into medicine and trying to think about what does this diagnosis mean for the person in front of me? What's it, how is it going to change their kind of trajectory and what things are going to be important to consider for them? So part of your kind of patient-centered care, essentially. But yeah, just allowing you to step away from what's the blood count, what's the paraprotein, and more, what are this patient's symptoms? What does it mean for them?
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently. I mean, I've got this patient who sort of now friends with because she's come out the other side of a really rocky course with AML. And I'm actually going to do a podcast with her because what I really want to do is ask really some really searching questions that you just wouldn't ask as a doctor because you, I guess maybe you don't really need to know, but the more personal things. So, you know, how does it feel to be sat there in front of someone in a clinic to be told you've got AML? Or how does it feel spending 4 weeks on your own in a room with no visitors? And how do those people feel when you come? They just come into your room, like the nurses and the doctors come into your room for a short amount of time? You know, I think understanding what impact we have on patients in those sorts of situations can probably make us spend more time or maybe ask some of those questions. And it really builds in that human approach, doesn't it? I mean, I think the time element is important to understand. And I guess, do we have time or do we not make time? One of my previous podcast guests, Gordon Caldwell, is a consultant, retired consultant now, and he now lives up in a beautiful part of Scotland. He's had this sort of social media campaign called hashtag cut the crap. And you might have seen there's like a viral photo of him lying next to reams of paperwork that sort of needs filling out for every medical patient that's admitted in this hospital. And his argument is, you know, a lot of this stuff's not evidence-based, doesn't make any difference. We should be spending this time having more meaningful interactions with our patients, because that's the thing that gives them satisfaction. It certainly gives us the satisfaction. I mean, am I on the right track here? I think having some time or taking time to try and understand that patient's story and be able to individualize their care or individualize your relationship with the patient is massively important. Is that what I'm sort of getting at, this narrative-based medicine?
I think so. And through trying to come up with my talk for Crucible, I thought, well, there's no point just speaking kind of esoterically about this. It's never going to go down well at a hematology conference. Mm-hmm. You've got to be coming out with, at the very least, ideas of how I think we could incorporate this day to day. And I think it's true. I think we are time pressured, you know, especially, you know, I would get quite lucky. I might get sort of 20 or even 40 minutes for a clinic slot in a way that a consultant never would. And it was trying to think, how can we target this so that I don't think that we're answering the questions that patients want us to. I think they'll hook on to a number, you know, what's my paraprotein or whatever it is, because it's this kind of weird shared thing that we can talk about. And it's because there isn't that time or space to discuss what it means for a patient. I wondered what it would be like to give someone a writing prompt before clinic, or ask them to bring a list of their questions or the things that they want to discuss, and just start with that. Don't even look at blood results until we've done it. I just wondered if they would. Yeah, I think they would direct consultations a completely different way to how we do. And it's true that time is probably the main factor that's stopping us. I don't think it's that any practitioner has no interest in their patients or their patient's disease. But I wondered how we could practically change that. And maybe clinic's not the space or the time for it. Maybe, you know, I think there used to be a lot more patient support groups, and that is something that suffered hugely following COVID. You know, literally a place to bring people together. And that's going to be so difficult for all of our immunosuppressed patients who have done their absolute best to not come together in groups. But I think those sorts of questions might come out better in that sort of environment. Equally, you've then got a group of people, and that, you know, it's, do you want to take advantage of your doctor-patient relationship? It's just that privacy of you and them versus having other patients that you can bounce experiences off.
Yes, again, it's something I've kind of been thinking about over the last few months, really, is that, you know, the way that medicine developed
isn't based on evidence, really, is it? You know, it's just sort of evolved like that, and it's based on historical precedent. You know, the idea of the ward round, the idea of the clinic, just all these sort of institutions within medicine that we just do and don't really think about, that they're not based on evidence, they're not necessarily the best way to do things. And the consultation is the same, you know. I think it's a really good idea to think about changing the paradigm. And you mentioned MGUS, and I think that's a good example. I mean, patients must feel nervous a few days before their clinic appointment. And yet the first thing we sort of do is go into the numbers. I guess maybe that is the first thing to do. Someone's nervous and their paraprotein is stable. And you say, look, just to break the ice, this paraprotein is absolutely fine, but how are you feeling about the whole thing? And I think that's certainly well worth trying to build into practice. I mean, the best thing with MGUS is probably not to test for it in the first place, but we'll see the results of the Icelandic iStop MM trial, which is a really neat study, and it'll tell us what we should be doing. But I mentioned one example there. What difference do you think it could make to patients and I guess our job satisfaction if we were to change our approach to this more sort of narrative based approach?
I think it would make a huge difference if patients thought they were being thought of as individuals, as opposed to the next person on the list. I think particularly in hematology, you're treating quite a lot of acute and fast-paced illnesses. Mm. Not always. Some things are getting to chat to people with CLL for years and years on end while they're fine. But, you know, having to win over someone's trust in the course of a week to start induction chemotherapy for AML or something like that. I think if that's always a one-way conversation with just the kind of essentially doctor's narrative of this is what the day setup is, this is what your next 10 days are going to look like, I don't see how that can be satisfying. Or maybe it might be reassuring for a patient to be given a structure like that, but I don't think it is satisfying for care, compared to if you walk into a situation, as you say, ask how are you, or if you're meeting them for the first time, say who are you, not just what has brought you to hospital, but you know, outside of these symptoms, who are you, what do you do day to day, do you have a family, what's important. And one of my colleagues, actually, who's an IMT, who's going into neurology, has started trying to do some of his consultations like that. And he'll say, you know, some patients aren't receptive. They want to crack on, talk about the, you know, tremor or whatever it is today. But some people are quite happy to get an idea of, for you to get an idea of who they are before you start with and what's the problem. And I think it would allow them to contextualize symptoms a bit better, you know, or like fatigue is that massive thing that we have to talk about in hematology because everyone's got it, but what does that mean? How is it stopping you from doing your job or engaging with your family or your hobbies? What impact's it having on your life? It's so much clearer if you already know that you know you've got a hill walker in front of you, or god forbid another doctor or whatever it is.
And I think you're right there, it makes sense to start like that, doesn't it? There's nothing worse than having a consultation where you're 5 minutes in and you've really dumbed everything down, and you then figure out that you've got a professor of neuroscience sat in front of you, and you know, you've pitched it completely wrong, or vice versa, where you've pitched it too high. I remember this this patient in a hematology malignancy clinic. I can't remember what he had. It's probably MDS or something. And I remember it was quite a difficult consultation, and it was a transplant consultation, and at the end, he was offered to ask any questions. He said, no, I'm okay. And he said to me, and this other junior doctor sitting in, do you want to ask me any questions? Which is kind of an interesting thing for a patient to say. But it turned out that he was a renal physiology professor. My colleague said, can you explain the countercurrent mechanism in the kidney? He said, oh, no one really understands that. So, yeah, patients can certainly surprise you. But I think from your approach, I think I would probably change to that approach. It makes a lot of sense to try and understand the patients in front of you before you're trying to treat them. I know when I used to sit in pediatric clinics, the prof of pediatrics always used to start with the history of, the past mode history and the family history, to just try and get a better understanding. I mean, that's not that holistic, but at least it's sort of setting the background. I mean, you can imagine an example of where you're in a clinic and someone comes in with leg pain, and it's only 10 minutes in that you realise they haven't got a leg, and it's actually phantom leg pain that you're sort of dealing with. But I mean, my approach to this would be, you know, that question we talked about, who are you, I think is a little odd. How do you word this question? How do you start consultations?
Maybe, you know, before we start talking about the problem today, it'd just be useful to get to know you. Who are you? What's your life like before you came to hospital today? I think my partner does it as, what would you be doing if you weren't in hospital today? And it kind of gets people started of, oh, it's a Tuesday, that's my meetings day. Oh, what's your job? And you sort of go from there. I think that's quite a nice way of doing it, actually. Okay. Yeah, I think there's a lot of different areas you would want to change to try and incorporate narrative. The stuff I was sort of focusing on in Crucible was people's opportunity for, or patients' opportunity for reflection by themselves, and then how they might want to bring that to a consultation or to their care. I think we ask people to make a lot of fast-paced decisions, and we want there to be, you know, maximum information available to them to make the most informed choice they can, so that their autonomy is being maximized. And I wonder how likely that is if we give this whirlwind 10-minute, you know, consenting experience with some information, and then we say, right, so are you ready to sign? Compared to, I mean, I know that's not how it's done. People are given stuff to take away and read, but I think if you had prompts to get people to write about how they're feeling about their treatment, how they feel about what's important to them, I wonder if they'd make different choices, or at least maybe be a little bit more prepared for the choice they're making. If, you know, you're saying what's important to you, and someone really sits down and thinks about it and is like walking the dog every day, I think, and being able to do my own shopping, and you're like, right, well, here's this treatment that's going to make you so fatigued and nauseated that you're not going to be able to get outside, or your alternative is, you know, something that allows you to do those things. I wonder if it would give a bit more space for people to bring their lives and choices into that medical decision as well.
I think that's a really enlightened way of thinking about it. I don't know if you saw this week, there was a write-up in the Lancet Oncology about a new organization called Common Sense Oncology, and the whole idea of this movement is to sort of rebalance the books away from drug companies and the trials that drug companies that they run to try and get FDA approval and sell the drug, from surrogate endpoints to looking at meaningful endpoints for patients, and to make sure that the drugs we use are effective. And I think what you say sort of resonates there. And without getting to know your patient, how do you recommend a treatment or not recommend a treatment? Because you want to get to know whether what your patient really values. Do they value length of life? Do they value going on holiday? I don't see how you can come up with treatment decisions without doing that. And obviously the best doctors do that, but to really try and deeply understand someone's priorities, I think is going to be important. I mean, all the time we've got new drugs for cancers. You know, lymphoma is a good example. There's new drugs all the time, and I remember this woman on a trial of a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and it was horrible. She was just getting horrible mouth ulcers, other GI stuff. She was miserable. She was in hospitals. A lot of social problems going on as well. And I think really, if we'd got to know her extensively and gone through things and really gone through the data and the chances of this helping her, she probably would have decided to stop. And I think that would have been a completely reasonable thing to do. Often these drugs don't have survival benefit. They certainly don't have quality of life benefit often. And she's not interested in PFS. All she wants to do is live longer and happier. Or at least that's what I assume. We always make this assumption of what patients care about is length of life and quality of life. Well, is that true? I mean, there's got to be more to that. So I think that's something that needs more treatment. But we, as doctors, we have this visceral reaction to want to treat, don't we? We really want to treat people. I've just written about this on my blog about intervention bias and how we're sort of evolutionarily primed to want to intervene because it, you know, it looks better, it feels better. And maybe narrative-based medicine is one of the ways to counterbalance that. And maybe one of the most powerful the powerful things with narrative-based medicine is to enable us to decide to stop. What do you think?
I think it could be involved in the choice to do something too. But yeah, absolutely. Some of the people I was thinking about, again, kind of while I was preparing for Crucible, I was working in the hematology day center, and the people you see the most are usually your MDS patients who are hooked on transfusions, and you're seeing them weekly or fortnightly or whatever, and they've got these long, long sits. And I think that's the people maybe you get to know best during that time. And it was those patients I ended up sort of running the, I did a thing for Crucible where I gave them writing prompts and they could submit anonymous answers to my question, or they could choose to keep them for themselves or just ignore it. And it was mostly them that I had in mind, because you've got this difficult, a lot of them were elderly and comorbid and frail and not eligible for more aggressive treatments, so just this kind of supportive approach. And I thought it must be so difficult to come into a day center and just ponder that, I suppose. And it can be so difficult to start bridging that conversation of, is this even benefiting you? I don't think we're very good at doing that for MDS patients anyway. I don't think there's a lot of evidence, as far as I've looked into, as to what is the, are there appropriate parameters? No, they're kind of set up on weird audit data from ages ago. Do we do baseline questioning about people's quality of life, fatigue symptoms, and then titrate against that? No, probably not. I just wondered what they were getting from these regular visits into hospital at a time of their life where actually they're probably coming towards the last months of their lives. And yeah, what do they think about with that? So I left these writing prompts of just, I think it was, what have you learned from living with your condition, or something quite broad. And yeah, just got really diverse, unexpected responses. And I'd left them for everyone. It wasn't just our kind of patients on supportive treatments. We had some young patients with lymphoma coming in for a treatment and so on. But it, despite how much time I felt I'd spent with people over those past few months, I realized through reading what they'd written that I didn't really know them at all, or what was important to them. And I wondered if that's because they had the privacy and the space to be able to write that. It was interesting that I tried to stay away from the unit on the day that I'd done it, so that I wasn't biasing anything they wrote. And all the nurses said everyone looked really excited to have been asked a question that's quite personal, but not medical. And some people just pocketed their answers to keep for themselves, which I actually really liked as well.
I really love that idea. What did you learn? Have you incorporated that into your practice now? I mean, I know you're a ward lackey at the moment, so that makes it a bit more challenging.
Yeah, and the tricky thing is that I'm on a stroke ward at the moment. And so while I was thinking about this and how I would want to do it, I then came to a new group of patients who struggle with communication. Just as I'd been saying, communication is going to be, I want to change it and do it differently.
Perhaps it's even more important in that group, because they can't communicate.
Yeah, we kind of rely on the speech and language team a lot, I suppose, for facilitating that. And they have all sorts of kind of picture variations. And it's made having those kind of broader conversations a lot more difficult. If you're relying on someone's ability to point at yes and no, your conversation is so limited. So I think, I just started thinking about all of these. How would I like to change my practice? How am I going to incorporate narrative? And then have just moved into an entirely different clinical area where that's been a lot harder to do.
I think if you tried to do this in a clinical environment, I mean, it sounds brilliant, doesn't it? And I can't think of many downsides. I mean, clearly with any new intervention, you think about possible harms. But I mean, what's the reaction of kind of colleagues or senior colleagues to these ideas? Are they broadly supportive, or skeptical, or just not interested? What sort of criticism do you get? Because, as doctors, we love to complain, don't we?
I think the majority of any criticism you get is just time pressures. And I think that was fair in the questions I got in Crucible too. So the majority of it seemed to be, sure, why not? That sounds relatively harmless. But yeah, how on earth are you going to incorporate this into your day? And then, of course, there was the question about kind of the need for unbiased data to progress treatment, and that kind of conversation ended up having about, I think everything is biased. We can try to remove kind of compounding factors as much as possible, but we don't, I don't think. And purely having that awareness through using narrative more often, reflection more often, I think we will at the very least be able to analyze data more accurately or use it more accurately. I think the majority of the questions seem to come around from not agreeing that things should be what am I thinking of, subjective.
I mean, even just the process of simply asking these sort of left field questions about their experience and how they feel will probably have an effect, because it just helps people be heard, and I think just giving them that chance would be beneficial.
And I wonder if you could have a big like a notice board, and people could, it could still be anonymous, but they could put their responses on there. And then you've got, multiple people having the same treatment who've maybe never met each other, seeing that, we're all experiencing something similar. I think it would be interesting. I also think having a more personalized perspective from a clinician, I wonder if that's impactful for patients too. I think it's something you see more in maybe consultants or doctors who are more experienced and more sure of themselves, that ability to say to a patient, we're in a gray area here and I honestly don't know what the best thing is for you. I've been thinking about this, when I go home and whatever, that kind of admission to a patient that almost feels a little bit personal. But I wonder how that impacts someone's ability to trust you. If you can say something that's that vulnerable, but let them know that you're considering what's best for them, and that you're not always this fantastic decision making machine that's just yes and no. And I wonder how that would impact that vulnerability. It's such a unique space, isn't it? Hematology and oncology, and needing to give a treatment that you know will cause some harm, ultimately trying for the best. And I think you need to, create that kind of space for trust and for vulnerability with your patients. Having the opportunity to not hide behind statements like, all the team's working towards the best option for you or whatever it is, but just to make I statements about how you feel as their doctor and what it's like to be treating them.
Yeah.
I think that might help.
Yes, it's a really interesting idea. I mean, I think the best way to tackle this is to get evidence, really. I mean, it seems to me that the main perceived barrier, well, the main barrier to sort of people taking up is this perception that it would take more time. So you want to try and show that might not be the case. I mean, if you were to think about it, you could have a randomized controlled trial where you have interventions like preclinical writing or just changing the structure of the consultation. You can randomize patients or cluster randomize or something to the style, or whether you have this pre-clinic intervention, and you could do it across like 10 doctors with loads of patients, and your primary outcome could be it doesn't take any more time, so the time of consultation, and then look at patient satisfaction, and even you could maybe look as well whether it impacts choices of treatment and things like this. But yeah, I mean the main barrier is time, so trying to show that it's time neutral would be really beneficial, and it's probably going to make more of a difference than another trial of a crappy drug that makes people miserable and extends progression-free survival by 2 months, so that patients can come to clinic and it's almost they get kind of counselling in a miniature sort of counselling session. They always look forward to clinic because they know they're going to be listened to. And no, I think it's a great idea. We should talk about this project in a bit more detail, because I think it'd be really impactful. Sophie, if I can, I just want to change tack slightly and ask about stories in research. And I read a really interesting article or paper a few months ago, and it's to do with how humans are evolved to be storytellers, and it has this survival advantage. So this group went to an indigenous population, some of the Pacific, and they looked at stories and looked at how people who were the best storytellers are more reproductively successful. And I guess it makes sense, because someone who's a great storyteller, someone you want to be around and spend time with. And it does make sense, really, that the better the story, the better your culture is passed down, and it allows for cultural cohesion. So a lot of the stories I think they looked at in these indigenous populations are to do with good and evil, and how evil always loses and good always wins, and it sort of trains our kids to be better people. I mean, my little kids, they're always sort of watching things like Paw Patrol, where the bad guy is always getting himself into scrapes and the Paw Patrol are always ploughing in and being the best of friends and saving this guy no matter how bad he is. And it's always about, you know, how you should be good. And we teach our kids this from a young age. But the important thing here is that, yeah, we evolve to be good storytellers, and that's an attractive quality. But I mean, my worry is that although we evolve to do that, as evolution often does, it leaves us vulnerable to bias, and certainly my sort of pet area of interest is direct reverse, and it's a really compelling narrative here. You know, we've given someone a Pixaban, they've bled inside the head, we need to give them something to turn it off. It's logical, and almost, you know, I think, oh, it's so logical we don't need to trial it properly, and you know, and I know that that's often a load of crap, because often when these things that are entrenched in medical practice that make a lot of logical sense are actually empirically tested, they don't work. And one of the great examples is stenting for stable coronary artery disease, where you find that it doesn't actually help. In fact, it just subjects people to harm by virtue of being on long-term antiplatelets and all the financial costs as well. I mean, you're a big proponent of using stories in medicine, but I do see how they can be harmful. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I was trying to think how narrative could be better incorporated in research and presentation of data. And I think it would, when I was writing Crucible, I ended up referencing John Bennett, who's credited as sort of characterizing at the very least leukemia, and does this through his, it's a weird combination of case report and sort of memoir, where he includes his own descriptions of what it's like to be the physician investigating these patients, and it's a beautiful old document you can get through the Wellcome Trust. And I thought it'd be really interesting because you don't really see clinician perspective in write-ups anymore. And again, it will be a time and a space thing. I'm sure there's a limit to how much space you can have in a journal, and you know. But on the one hand, I think it would be really interesting, compelling to listen to someone. It's like those expert stories, isn't it? How I treat bleeding in ITP or whatever. You can picture yourself, because they're telling it as a story about them as an individual. You can picture yourself in that clinic room trying to make that decision. And so on the one hand, it's interesting, it will be useful for your memory, but on the other hand, you are getting one person's perspective, and it might well be an expert perspective, but it is still one person in one scenario. So there's definitely a risk of bias, of only some people's voices being heard. I don't know, probably some countries are obviously going to publish a great deal more than others, and it's different populations. So yeah, absolutely. I think the voice that can be heard through choosing to have or express a narrative can become incredibly narrow, and then that can yeah, as you say, they can be powerful. It can alter what people do. If you trust in that as an important voice in that area, and you go with only what they think, then your practice could change, and it could be for the worse. So absolutely, I can see that. Mm-hmm. I think having an awareness of that is probably the most important thing. You could have all of your, you know, you could be involved in doing a trial, doing a study, have a little statement at the beginning going, this is what it's like to be a doctor trying to treat in this huge gray area. That was part of the motivation for this study, and then also include what it would be like maybe for a patient to be receiving that treatment, how they think or feel about it. Really, it would just be some different perspective alongside, you know, look at these confidence interval bars. And
that's such a fascinating idea. I mean, yeah, just incorporating that into your academic manuscript. You know, we did this trial because we just don't know what to do, and we always feel uncomfortable in front of patients, and it's such a grey area, and we've got this emotional connection to this subject, and that's why we did it, and this is the story of us. What a brilliant thing. I'm going to do that. Sophie, this has been really lovely. I just want to finish by asking you about your beautiful artwork. Is it online somewhere?
Yeah. So I have an Instagram account that you're welcome to link, that I don't update as much as I'd like to anymore.
Plug it.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's at Sophie T Evans. The drawing, I think I tried to talk about this at Crucible as well, is it's sort of a sub branch of narrative based medicine, actually called graphic medicine. And I kind of came across it through a mixture of reading and drawing. So when I started as a doctor in my foundation years, I found myself drawing quite a lot of comics of just like funny stuff that had happened at work. And you obviously change it so it's anonymized or whatever, but the scenario would be there. It's, you know, someone's put something up their bum, or I don't know, things that made me laugh. You can tell I started on a surgical job, because quite a lot of the stories would be funny and have a happy ending. And I just found that I was using them to reflect a lot. So I started as an F1 in 2019, and then obviously 6 months later COVID happened, and all of a sudden you're a fresh new doctor in the start of a new pandemic, living alone, and it was really unnerving. And I was using this to reflect, and found this space of graphic medicine of practitioners and patients who are doing the same thing worldwide. And using it as an opportunity to come together and also to reflect. And I think there is something brilliant about art in that I can draw something and then look back on it and wonder why I chose to represent it that way. And very often I will have drawn myself alone in a scenario, and I won't have been. There'll be a team there, and you think, well, why didn't I feel supported? What was missing in that scenario? And there's multiple opportunities to reflect. There's as you're doing the drawing, and then there's later. So I kind of got involved in it that way, and then there are drawing groups run by the graphic medicine community. Can't recommend them enough. I'm fairly sure it's just graphicmedicine.com, or Google it. And it was all set up by a GP called Ian Williams, who works out of Brighton now and has written these amazing books. He started out with The Bad Doctor, which is kind of a semi-autobiographical, but I think mostly fictional, account of a GP in rural Wales, not only going through all the fascinating patient encounters that you might expect in rural Wales and with farmers who present at the last minute, but also battling his own kind of mental health difficulties and what it's like to try and come in as a professional every day while you're having those struggles yourself. And they're these beautiful graphic novels anyway, but also that's quite a unique perspective from a doctor that I don't really think was that well known before. So he sort of coined graphic medicine, and even though it may have been done years and years before, has kind of started this big community. And there's a conference every year now. I think sometimes it's been in the UK, but mostly it's in the States or in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it brings together clinicians who want to use art as a means of reflection, but also patients as well. And I think it's a very interesting way of trying to reflect on your experiences.
I'm just looking at your Instagram here, and there's some brilliant ones. The fantastic one on the right at the top, which is what people think hematology is like, and it's just this sort of doctor ominously standing behind a patient going, I need your blood. And it's a really good capture of what hematology really is like, because often we don't really care what the patient's doing, we just want to know what that full blood count is. That's not completely true, but I mean, I know Sophie does commissions. We've discussed this before, but please don't be one of those people who ask for it for free, because they take a lot of time. But if you're interested in commissioning Sophie something, I'm sure she'd be
grateful because she's, as I'm, a poor junior doctor. But these, they're just brilliant. They just give this immediate snapshot of someone's thinking, and it does convey a message much, much quicker than writing. So yeah, I'm sold. This is brilliant. And that's Sophie T. Evans on Instagram. I've just got it up now. Wow, 749 followers. Is that good?
That happened after one of them. I think it was a cheeky one. I think I'd been about to examine a patient and discovered through looking at some of their imaging that they had some intimate piercings that I just wasn't expecting. And so I just was just reflecting on the fact that we make these prejudgments about people before we've literally even seen the person reading a letter or whatever, and we can be so surprised. And yeah, I think that just that hit a nail for people. They seem to like it.
Oh, Sophie, this has been really cool. Real treat for me to speak to you about all these interesting things and have a look at your art and things. And I definitely want to get you speaking at Heme Star Day or something like that, because I think you've got some really interesting ideas to share. And I hope this podcast is listened to by a few people that it really makes a difference to. So that's brilliant. Stay in touch and take care.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Don't Just Read the Guidelines is for education and entertainment only and should not be taken as medical advice. I certainly cannot guarantee the factual accuracy of any of the content, but if you do have any constructive criticism, please find me on Twitter at Richard Booker. If you like the show, please take the time to write a review on iTunes, Google, or wherever else you listen. It will really help others find the podcast. See you soon.